Carl, we meet again.
Oh, a pleasure, Eric, always.
All right. Good. We're out in Sag Harbor, New York.
Yes.
Are we in the East Hampton Sag Harbor or the Southampton Sag Harbor?
The Southampton Sag Harbor. There's a street in the village of Sag Harbor. It's aptly called Division Street, which divides the town of Southampton and the town of East Hampton in terms of who has jurisdiction over this area called Sag Harbor.
So this is kind of a census-designated place, and that spreads across two municipalities.
Yeah, it's an old place. Actually, the original name was Sagaponack Harbor, because these early European settlers, after they paid the Native Americans who were not into selling. I mean, I don't think they knew what was happening.
No.
And in any case, when they acquired property and created farms, Sagaponack, a very beautiful community. Truman Capote called it Kansas by the Sea, and it still is very rural, and there's the ocean next
what
to
did he, what was the word?
Kansas, like the state of Kansas.
Oh, Kansas by the Sea.
By the sea. I mean, here are these beautiful farms like you'd find in Kansas. Right next to the ocean, so it's kind of unusual. But they needed a harbor. The early European settlers, and they couldn't make a harbor out of the coastline there, right, abutting the ocean. But about 6-7 miles up to the north was a natural deep water port, in fact, Sagaponack Harbor, and the name was shortened to Sag Harbor. And it was big during the whaling days. The Native Americans taught the settlers how to catch whales or hunt for whales, and in turn, the Europeans overfished the whales. And, by the time the Civil War came, the whaling, which was what Sag Harbor was dependent on, was not happening. And also oil came in. And then later on...
Kerosene.
And then the early... in the early 20th century, what came in to Sag Harbor were a variety of industries, including a big watch case factory, which you passed on Route 114 coming here.
It still exists?
Well, it's now a high-end apartment complex. It was all renovated and modernized.
What's the name of that thing?
It was originally Fahey's, F-A-H-E-Y, was the guy's name. It was French. Mm-hmm. Fahey was French. And actually, my grandfather came from Hungary. He was a Hungarian Jew and an engraver. And Fahey's met would-be engravers that he would employ in his watch case factory just as they came off the ships on Ellis Island. And he would take them to Sag Harbor.
How would he know they were engravers?
Well, he probably
had a knack for picking them out, like artists and repertoire of engravers. He just stand there loitering around the Great Hall of Ellis Island and be like, "Yo, you look like an engraver. Come with me. Here's $100."
Well, I don't think they had identification on their modest clothing, but
except for chalk marks.
But that's how my grandfather came to Sag Harbor.
As an engraver to work in that
the watch
factory?
Case factory?
So you didn't like migrate here from the city or something? You
no
were
no
kind of born
I,
here.
I'm not a native. My grandfather Herman Grossman, he had the bright idea after meeting Stephanie Spitz in, Stephanie Spiegel, her sister, married into the Spitz family in Sag Harbor. She was Stephanie Spiegel, and she was with her sister, visiting her sister. So they settled in Sag Harbor, my grandfather and grandmother on my father's side. But then my grandfather had the bright idea that he could make more money in the city than working in Sag Harbor. So he headed to the city, and the Depression hit. He, in the stress of the Depression, he lost his job, and in that stress, had a heart attack and died.
Oh, dear.
And actually, Arthur Spitz, who was of the family and to which my great aunt married. She said, "Oh, your grandfather made a terrible mistake. He should have stayed here, because during the Depression," and Arthur Spitz was a village trustee in Sag Harbor and so forth, "during the Depression, we were able to go to Bridgehampton and glean for potatoes." In other words, we were able to eat during the Depression, while my poor grandfather and grandmother really had nothing, and they lived in East New York.
Right, in Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn, and that's where my father was born, and that was where I come from, East New York and Brooklyn.
I see. Okay, and then you chose to come back out here.
Well, years later, the East End of Long Island and Sag Harbor is part of it, still is kind of the country. Less and less, but kind of the country. Mm-hmm. And 50 years ago, when we bought this saltbox house that we're talking in today, a 100-plus-year-old saltbox house, I really felt that I'm not crazy about suburbia. I can deal with the city. Cities are interesting and lively and full of energy. And I kind of love the country.
Yep.
The middle...
This is not the suburbs.
No, it's not the suburbs.
It gets there in East Hampton. I kind of close my eyes. It's not really safe to drive with your eyes closed, but when I drive through East Hampton, I close my eyes the whole time.
Well, East Hampton 50 years ago wasn't like this.
Right.
Now it's like the Upper East Side, and particularly because of COVID. Because of COVID, you've had all these COVID refugees who went to their summer homes, their vacation places on the East End for good.
Yeah,
many of them have stayed. Some have gone back to the city, but still, for an area that's 100 miles from Manhattan. It's still nice. I mean, the sprawl, which is kind of enveloped mile after mile from the middle of Manhattan into Jersey, up into Westchester, into Nassau County, where I teach. Really hasn't gotten the sprawl so far out here. And there's been efforts like the Farmland Preservation Program, and there's a huge community, a fund in which people have to pay into when they purchase real estate now out here, which goes to saving farmland and saving open space and so forth. There's been a very big effort to keep this area, to keep it rural. In fact, I once did a 10-part series when we just moved out here, called "Can Suffolk Be Saved?" As to whether this movement of sprawl could be stopped, which was actually it was WLIW Channel 21 on Long Island ran the series, and so did WOR TV, then in New York City, ran the 10-part series, which began incidentally on Gardner's Island, which is privately held. It's just
the whole island.
The whole island. And I said that this is really a kind of a baseline for what the most beautiful areas of Long Island once were.
Right.
And it's still a privately held island, 3,000 plus acres, quite beautiful. It's between the forks.
What's it called again?
Gardner's Island.
Gardner's Island.
Yeah, for the family. Lion Gardner was an engineer for King Soho. I don't know which English king, and was sent here. And,
That's a while ago.
A few years ago. He's buried in East Hampton. It's the fancy schmancy grave. But he then paid off, Indian chief for this big island in blankets, I think a dog and some other stuff. Again, how the Native Americans were cheated out of...
They had $24 from Manhattan. They had no concept. It was ceremonial to them. They didn't think of it as like right title and interest.
No. It wasn't. That wasn't real estate.
The concept, yeah.
That wasn't their concept. It was the land, the water was all part of, from a spiritual point of view, kind of part of their universe.
Yeah, right. I believe there should be memorials to the Native Americans pretty much everywhere. And you cannot find them. You find some museums here and there. There's a really decrepit thing at Wounded Knee.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of battle scenes all throughout the Hudson Valley, probably here. Wasn't it the Long Island Indian War? It was a famous Indian War for the Battle of Brooklyn, I think it was called. Yeah.
Well, on the other hand, in terms of statues, there's this big statue of Robert Moses in the middle of the village of Babylon.
Oh, where's that? I need to deface it.
Well, and
I'm not much of a vandal, but Robert Moses, that should get a bucket of red paint.
Well, I've written and I have a column that runs in these
papers. Please, I hope you called for the removal
there's been a grassroots effort in the village of Babylon to get rid of it, because he was racist.
Completely. That's why all the bridges are so low.
So low, so the people of color from
can't
the city.
Can't ride buses, can't fit buses on the parkways.
Couldn't go to Jones Beach. And my first big story as a journalist is how actually I got into doing the kind of investigative reporting that I've done, focusing on the environment, was he had, as the power broker by Robert Caro relates, the media of New York City in his pocket. But there was one little paper here on Long Island called the Babylon Town Leader, and he lived in Babylon and had been fighting with Moses for decades. And when I first arrived, it was an ad in the New York Times for a reporter. I was told to go to Fire Island that weekend because Moses had just announced, because he was nuts about cars.
Get hired, and your first assignment was to go to
Fire Island. Robert Moses had just announced he was going to build a four-lane highway the length of Fire Island.
Great idea.
35 miles.
You have to know at Fire Island, it's a sandbar. It's a place you don't have to put your shoes on, the whole place. Used to be when I went there, you didn't have to put your shoes on.
A barefoot paradise, indeed. Moses claimed that this highway would anchor the barrier beach, would anchor Fire Island. In fact, what we found...
Physically anchor it?
Physically anchor it. Somehow you put down asphalt and cement, and it would keep the island...
But you found that it would just make the whole thing erode.
Well, in fact, it wouldn't be just Fire Island. Barrier beaches need to move with nature to protect the mainland, so it would be more than Fire Island ending up subject to erosion if you threw down a four-lane highway. But then we went to... My editor, John Marr, and I went to the Jones Beach stretch, where there actually is a four-lane highway that Moses had built. And because we had heard, and we confirmed, that bulldozers worked in the middle of the night, so people wouldn't know, scouring sand from both sides of the Ocean Parkway on the Jones Beach stretch to keep the road in place. So that road didn't anchor that, which is just to the west of Fire Island, that portion of the South Shore Barrier Beach. So in any case, that was I wrote week after week about Moses and things Moses, I mean, how he created a car-dependent culture on Long Island with the Long Island Expressway, so-called. Not much of an express on the expressway, Southern State Parkway with the low bridges, and the Northern State, same thing. And what I crusaded for, campaigned for, was an alternative. You couldn't stop Moses on the state level. He had run for governor in the 1930s, lost by a then record amount. And so he decided to achieve power through
bureaucracy,
commissions and authorities.
Yeah.
And we couldn't stop him on the state level because he felt that he couldn't be governor. He would be as powerful, if not more powerful, than a governor. Right. Running all these commissions and authorities. So what was done is that we sought out the federal government. And even though it was a very early idea at that point, a national seashore, my stories involved crusading for a Fire Island national seashore, though the New York Times and Newsday was still for the highway. They were in Moses' pocket. Ultimately, in 1964, a Fire Island National Seashore was created.
What year?
1964.
Uh-huh.
I started in 62 and wrote and wrote and wrote. And, I succeeded, in fact, in the aim, which was to stop the road, stop the highway, which would have just devastated the 17 unique communities on Fire Island, and also beautiful nature, like the Sunken Forest, you know, which just lovely. It would have just paved over the nature and the extraordinary communities on Fire Island. But this was what Moses specialized in.
Yeah.
In New York City, just
Cross Bronx over. Expressway, the World Trade Center.
Yeah. And he never drove. He had a chauffeur. I mean, the story is he didn't have to drive. But he loved cars. He was crazy for cars.
Uh-huh.
So in any case, that's when I began specializing, combining investigative reporting with environmental issues.
Okay, so you really start as a local journalist. This is local journalism.
Well, I didn't plan to do it that way. Just explain in terms of how I got into journalism. I had no interest in going into journalism. I went to Andrew Jackson High School in Queens, and the school newspaper at St. Albans in Queens, and the school newspaper was run by a bunch of girls from Laurelton. And it was like a sorority, and I've always been like not into in-groups. You know? But then I went off to Antioch College and in Ohio, and well, my girlfriend, who was the person who just gave you some coffee, this being 63 years later, my wife was getting a job. It was an internship. They called it at Antioch a cooperative. Antioch began a program. This goes way back with Arthur Morgan, who was its president, back in the 1930s, maybe the 20s. And he believed that what they call now experiential learning would be very important.
Mm-hmm.
So it was set up so you'd go to the college in Yellow Springs, Ohio for a quarter, not even a semester, just 3 months. And then you'd have an internship or a co-op for 3 months or longer. Some of them were 6 months. And go back to school, go to the co-op and for 5 years. And my girlfriend at the time was seeking an internship at the Cleveland General Hospital, taking care of kids with tuberculosis. And I figured this would be a good way to be with my girlfriend in Cleveland. And one of the openings was for a copy boy at the Cleveland Press. And this is corny story stuff. Above the Cleveland Press was the motto of this newspaper: give the people the light and they'll find their own way, was the motto. And there was like a lighthouse carved into the granite. And it wasn't just a motto. I mean, as a copy boy, I for example, when you'd work the night shift, if you got a call from somebody saying there'd be a press conference involving Cleveland itself, you gave a little memo to the city desk. Or if it was something happening in Shaker Heights, you gave a memo to the suburban desk. But if they called, and somebody called with a horror story, some story of injustice, inequity, unfairness, you put a memo together. And the term investigative reporting wasn't used back then. And muckraking had been the words used, you know, between around 1900 and 1914, the muckraking era, so-called, where the press really challenged power, authority.
Yep.
In this country. But I guess he gave...
Well, this is Jacob Riis. This is... he was one of them.
Well, it's Upton Sinclair, who
yep,
wrote
The
books,
Jungle.
Ida Tarbell, Lincoln Steffens, and so forth. And in fact, E.W. Scripps, who was the founder of the Cleveland Press, it was his first newspaper, he and Pulitzer were the two mainstream media publishers active in the muckraking era. And when I was there, this is now 1960, on this internship, I saw the culture that Scripps had created, to wit, I would give my little memo to the clutch of, they weren't called investigative reporters, but that's what they did. And the amazing thing to me was to see these reporters document the material I was given, and there'd be a resolution to the problem.
Yeah.
Not all the time, but about half the time.
Mm-hmm.
I was so impressed. I mean, indeed, if you give the people the light, they'll find their own way. They'd pressure government. They'd pressure, well, they put pressure in society, on society, to do right. And these problems were solved. I thought this was the neatest thing. So I said, the hell with college. I'm not going to sit in a classroom anymore. I'm going back to New York. So, I mean, Cleveland, I didn't know the territory. It's a nice city. It's like a small New York, diverse. But I just jumped back on my motorcycle with my girlfriend, Janet, who you met earlier today, on the back, and we headed back to New York. And then my aim was to get to the New York Herald Tribune, which I always considered a better newspaper than the New York Times. I mean, these were the two very prestigious newspapers in New York, of the 13 of them when I grew up.
Well, there were a lot of really racy tabloids.
And the Mirror and the
Daily News. Daily News was...
But the finer newspapers was the Times, but what the Times in my time has been called like the Pravda of Wall Street, not a exactly the people's paper, but the Tribune was different. And so my aim was to get to the Tribune. And my girlfriend was from Huntington on Long Island, and that's where we finally, well, the destination was Long Island, and we settled on Long Island. Got married very, very early. We were all of 19. And I started in journalism on Long Island with the first job, this weekly in Babylon, Fighting Moses. And then I went to the Daily Long Island Press. And ultimately, I specialized in investigative reporting for the press. And then when the press went out, particularly because of what I was focusing on at that point, nuclear power. Long Island was being eyed by the nuclear industry as...
What year is this now? The 70s?
Yeah, this is 1977. The Herald Tribune, incidentally, went out of business in 67. And in 77, I had to make a choice. The Long Island Press was then, after 100 and some odd years, going out of business. And the choice was to... Well, I thought maybe the Times. Reluctantly, I'd go to the Times. But what I was told by buddies at the Times was when I wrote a letter suggesting that I be a regional environmental correspondent and cover the encirclement of New York City by nuclear power plants, you know, Indian Point and Salem and on Long Island, there was to be 7 to 11.
Yeah, the park.
First being Shoreham nuclear power
the park. The nuclear park.
That's what the nuclear, in the parlance of the nuclear promoters at the time.
It was nice with a seesaw and a merry-go-round.
Aye, fay. Well, the thing about nuclear power plants, they needed a massive amount of water, 1 million gallons a minute. That's what a big nuclear plant needs. And at one point, the plan was to build a nuclear plant in Ravenswood in Queens, right across the East River from Manhattan, in the geographic center of New York. But that was stopped by some of the early anti-nukers in the city, some of whom then got involved, same folk, in fighting this plan for 7 to 11 nuclear power plants on Long Island. In any case, I wrote a letter to this editor who was discussing with me going to the time. I won the George Polk Award for a big expose, a big, huge sand mine on Long Island. Some character, his name was George Sumerjian, told the officials in Riverhead that he was going to build a deep water port. And Riverhead didn't have access, like the people in Sagaponack many years before, didn't have access to a harbor, but he will build a deep water port in Jamesport. In fact, he wasn't, as I was able to expose, going to build a deep water port. He was just digging a huge sand mine and barging the sand off to Connecticut to be mixed with cement to make concrete for the highways, the interstate highway system that was built in.
Under the ruse of making a port.
Deep water. So I got a George Polk Award for that. And so I was, you know, a good candidate for the Times. But when I wrote this letter...
In certain ways you were, yeah.
Well, you know...
Certain other ways, maybe not so much.
Maybe not. And you know, I write about offshore oil drilling planned for Long Island, which I had... The story I had broken in 1970 at the Long Island Press. Well, and so forth. But in any case, when particularly the nuclear issue was raised by me, they considered that I was into advocacy. In fact, I have a book outside on the porch by Phil Shabakov, who ultimately became the national environmental correspondent of the New York Times. He was then transferred to the Treasury Department and the IRS because he wrote a story. I did a TV show with him on environmental journalism because he wrote a story about he used the line, the slaughter of dolphins. And the Times considered his use of the word slaughter advocacy. But as in any case, what I finally decided to do was I got a call from this college, SUNY College at Old Westbury, which was kind of like Antioch in a way. It was Antioch students were on the planning committee. It was to be an experimental college, mostly because the private colleges in Nassau County, Delphi, Hofstra, Long Island University, felt very threatened by a four-year SUNY college in Nassau. So they made an experimental college and with a mission, social change, social justice. In fact, what I was called to, this is 1978, right after the press went out, I was asked if I could teach a course in environmental journalism, which is purportedly the first
ever
class in environmental journalism in the U.S. It was begun by Deidre English, who was now on the faculty at the University of California School of Journalism. And she had gone off, left Old Westbury to be the editor of Mother Jones. And they needed somebody to teach this very early investigative reporting class. And this is what I did. And so I got the job, and that was 1978. It's like 44 years ago.
But you hadn't graduated college yet.
No, that was a problem. I 2 years before I graduated college in a strange way, kind of, as some of the people in the press were saying that we're getting the vibes that we got at the Journal American and the Herald Tribune and the Telegram that the paper may be going out. I said, I better get a degree quick. I need a parachute here. And SUNY has a program. It's Empire State College. Wonderful. Wonderful program. I've mentored since.
It's kind of a college without walls kind of program.
College without
similar
walls.
Similar to Antioch, I guess.
And well, no, Antioch gets classes,
right?
Internships.
But the possibility, there's none of that at Empire State. It's just correspondence entirely.
Well, you meet with your mentor, and you can do internships, and you get a credit for life experience. And I had plenty of life experience at that point. So I did 6 months of study with a wonderful mentor at Empire State College, and I got my bachelor's degree. And then when I got to Old Westbury, they said, you're going to need a master's. It's kind of to get tenure normally, you need a PhD. But certainly a master's, and I didn't know kind of how to do that. I mean, I'm going to be with a bunch of 17-year-olds in an intro to journalism class after being a daily newspaper reporter for 13 years. So I found New School for Social Research, had a program in media studies, which was actually started by Marshall McLuhan through Antioch. Antioch set him up at New School to teach and to run a little program. And then he went off to St. John's. But it was a wonderful experience because I did media. But to understand media theory, particularly McLuhanesque media theory. So I got my master's and just quickly, then I said after that, put myself eligible for tenure. NYU had a program in media ecology, it was called. Neil Postman ran it. And I was willing to go. Some of the New School professors had gone to this program at NYU. And I'd be willing to go there, but this wonderful academic vice president we had at SUNY Old Westbury, Selby Hickey, her uncle was a reporter in Boston, so she knew about journalism. And she said, Carl, when you've written, I'd written two, three books then, first being Cover Up, what you're not supposed to know about nuclear power, what the New York Times didn't want me to write about, I finally...
Did they give you a good review? Did they review the book?
Never reviewed the book.
Bestseller list? Did it make the Times bestseller list?
Well, no, but it was a big seller for this
I keep several copies in my office for people, in case they're interested, I can give them one on the way out
the
door.
Well, it's actually online for free. After the Fukushima accident, the publisher who... the Shepherds, Marty and Judy Shepherd, who actually had a little publishing house, literally, in Sag Harbor down Noyack Road from me. After a hot literary agent, after the Three Mile Island accident, knew about my writings on nuclear, tried to get a publishing house in New York to have me write a book, because I told Hilda Lindley that I was, you know, like to write a book on Three Mile Island and nuclear in general. And she came back several weeks later. I can't believe it, she said, Cole. They're all telling me that there'll be no interest in nuclear power after a few months. But this small publishing house here in Sag Harbor, Permanent Press, its name.
Permanent Press.
Permanent Press. Marty had a good, has a, he passed last year, a good sense of humor. Met him at a get-together in Sag Harbor, and I told him the story I'm talking about now. And he said, we'll publish it, and it's become a bestseller for the Permanent Press. And after the Fukushima accident, Marty called and said, well, we got now Three Mile Island, we got Chernobyl, now Fukushima with three of the nuclear plants exploding. Let's see if they can, you know, pick up the book. You can do a new introduction. I said, fine. I start writing the new introduction. And then Marty comes back to me a few weeks later. They won't touch it. And Marty says, not only will I publish a new edition, but let's put it online for free. And if anybody just wants to go to my website, carlgrossman.com, Carl with a K, Grossman, one word, .com, just hit the button that says books, and you can download, cover up what you're not supposed to know about nuclear power, the whole latest edition for free. And why it's kind of an evergreen book is that I figured I'm not going to be able, with a narrative, to deal with the baloney from the nuclear pushers, promoters. But if I use segments of corporate documents and government documents, and just, this is before desktop publishing, and just paste them down on the flats, people will, well, this isn't Grossman's thinking. I mean, this is the document. For example, there's a line in the WASH 740 update, big report on safety issues regarding nuclear power plants. About, I mean, there it is, the big, and it's repeated about 200 times in this long, long report, several hundred pages. A big accident could, a word like devastate an area the size of the state of Pennsylvania. Mm. And that's in the movie, The China Syndrome, the Jane Fonda movie. And somebody comments, you know, in effect, that the line isn't from Hollywood. It's, in fact, from a government document. And I have it pasted.
Oh, the line
down.
That it's not from Hollywood is in the movie, The China Syndrome?
Yeah, well, they refer to it as in a government document.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, you know, the screenwriter of China Syndrome didn't concoct. And other, I begin the book cover up with, and it's from my insurance policy, homeowner's insurance policy for this little soapbox house. It's called the nuclear clause. And I advise people that look at your homeowner's policy, and you'll see that every homeowner's policy in the U.S. has a nuclear clause that says this policy doesn't cover the loss of caused by nuclear radiation,
Is this because they have indemnification?
Yeah, the Price-Anderson Act of,
So that indemnification translates into a line, a clause in every homeowner's insurance policy?
Because the original Price-Anderson limit on liability is $560 million, with the government paying the first $500 million. This is a way to encourage the electric industry, utility industry to build nuclear plants, and all they would have to pay in the event of a Chernobyl or a Fukushima here is $60 million. And I cut out from my policy with a scissor, pasted it down, and I mean, you may be in good hands with Allstate, which is the company that, you know, covers this house. You'd have had a slip and fall, but not if the Millstone nuclear plants across the Sound. erupted in Eastern Long Island.
Toasted and, the whole
and,
neighborhood.
And then just to make it clear, I got the policy, the model policy of homeowners insurance from the CNA, which is big insurance, cut that out and put it under the Allstate one. And the book is, it's really, it enables people to this day, and it was published in 1980, to this day, over 40 years later, to go to kind of primary documents to see why nuclear power is enormously dangerous. And then I have a chapter in alternatives. And even then, the solar alternative was, well, like on this roof of this house, there is 38 solar panels with 24% efficiency, even though back then the efficiency was about 8%. Still, you don't need nuclear power. Safe, clean, green power is what I argue in the book in a chapter. Tidal and wave power, and not just solar power, geothermal power, hot, dry rock geothermal power, and so forth. And then I have the last chapter is, what can you do? And I go around the world, in fact, interviewing people and asking them what you think is the best way to. So in any case, that's my first book, and it's available. Thankfully, you have a copy. And it's available to anybody listening to this just by going to my website, hitting the book button, and downloading the whole book, and you'll be armed with information.
I'll put a direct link to it. We're speaking with Carl Grossman in Sag Harbor, New York, talking about his humble beginnings as an investigative reporter. And you prove my point that you don't really have to go too far to find a good story. You found one right in your file cabinet, right on the homeowner's insurance policy. Mm-hmm. You can just pretty much look anywhere. I mean, there's always something interesting to say, something interesting to discover.
Well, and not only that, like I mentioned, these people would call when I'd be a copy boy in the middle of the night sitting at a little desk at the Cleveland Press with these horror stories. This is like we live in a smorgasbord of horror stories.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like an endless buffet. And the only issue to me, frankly, is time in my life to document the horror stories and hope that there'll be a resolution. And in my life, like I observed at the Cleveland Press, 50% of the time you could rectify the situation. For example, the road was never built, the Moses Road. These plans for 7 to 11 nuclear power plants on Long Island, 3 at Shoreham, that Jamesport site, it shows you when you stop one thing, but another thing arises. Then was eyed after I stopped this George Simergian from digging all the making. This huge sand pit. I mean, it's a mile by mile. Then that was eyed as a place for 4 nuclear power plants.
Nice.
Since then, thankfully, I mean, the nuclear thing was stopped. And I'm told I was a key ingredient. My journalism was very important. A young man came over this house a few years ago when he had written a thesis for graduate school, and he names me as a pivotal figure in the end of this nuclear power program on Long Island. And there's other examples I can give. I mean, as long as there's a modicum of democracy, investigative reporting, challenging authority through the media, through the press, can work very successfully. Mm-hmm. The issue today is, well, like with Trump, God forbid he should be elected again, and others all around the world, in Turkey, in Hungary, where my grandfather came from. I mean, this is the homeland, so to speak, of part of my family. The autocrats, these dictatorial types have been taking over rapidly in recent years. And for a free press, which will do crusading journalism, which will do what was called muckraking over 100 years ago, which will do what's been called since the early 70s, investigative reporting, is threatened. It really is threatened. I mean, who was the reporter who was murdered just a few months ago in Nevada by a public official? I mean, this is a very direct suppression of media. Who you have on the Supreme Court today, a person like Clarence Thomas, among the arch conservatives who were haters of the press.
Well, he was an attorney for Monsanto at the height of the company's atrocity. He was a regulatory affairs attorney for Monsanto at the height of its atrocities with dioxin.
Well,
and he does not recuse himself from those cases.
A friend of mine at the Long Island Press, more than a friend, he was the Suffolk editor, covered a lot of civil rights stuff back, you know, way back then. And he got a job after the paper folded with the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission. He was an investigator. And then this person named Clarence Thomas became the
commissioner.
Yeah, and he said, whew.
Yeah.
I mean, this man is terrible on many levels. One of them being the importance of a free press. In fact, not only the importance, the need, the necessity. I mean, it's a central element if you're going to have a democracy, a press, again, not to tell that corny
story. First Amendment. It is the First Amendment.
Yeah, but to give people the light, truly, like that Scripps-Howard motto says. And Trump himself, you know, talking about the press being, how does he word it, evil. You know, let me just take that phone off the hook. Okay.
So who exactly was calling a free press evil?
Well, it was Trump, you know,
over
and over again. And I mean, if he, again, God forbid, is reelected, one of his major themes is going to be to change the libel law in the United States. Very famous case, the New York Times versus Sullivan, sets up a new system in terms of defamation for public officials, that they have to prove that something was published or aired which was false, with reckless disregard that it was false, and with malice. And that's really helped investigative reporting a great deal, because I was asked to go to Australia, which they don't have this kind of press protection, to speak about that at the, I think it's called University of Technology in Sydney. Actually, it made news in Australia, my talk about how this New York Times versus Sullivan really opened up the press in America to challenge, to even better challenge authority, challenge. I mean, the whole way this country was set up was there'd be a judicial branch and a legislative branch and an executive branch, and a free press, which would challenge the whole kit and caboodle. It would be, you know, a check and balances with the press very much involved. I mean, it didn't start with muckraking. You know, it didn't start with Woodward and Bernstein and Watergate. It actually begins the theory of the American press challenging power with actually James Franklin, Benjamin Franklin's brother, before there was a United States, and John Peter Zenger in 1735, before there was a United States, here in New York, challenging authority, challenging power. And then all that being put together in our Constitution in the first, I mean, Benjamin Franklin was, beyond being a diplomat, he was not just a printer, he was a journalist. He published the Pennsylvania Gazette before the Revolution, most popular publication in the colonies before the Revolution. So he had a hand in putting together a system, which to me is wonderful. Thomas Jefferson, also a great, you know, a believer, and Jefferson, well, he writes in one letter how the Federalists fill their newspapers with lies, but I'll defend their right to lie, because he was into a free press, and that a press could not be limited, could not be restricted, and still be free, and let the truth rise to the top like cream. That's been our system. But I tell my students, every generation has to work to keep that system, because people in power, whether they're at this point prime ministers in Hungary or Turkey or Myanmar or whatever, feel uncomfortable with a free press. And China, of course. I remember the first, when I was in China, I opened the newspaper that first day, and there was this story quoting, I think it was the prime minister, having made this wonderful speech. And what is this, you know? In Russia, in the 1990s, I spent a lot of presentations in Russia, as the country opened up in many respects, including in terms of a free press. But now with Putin and journalists being killed with some regularity in Russia, I mean, so you add up Russia and China and all these other countries that have Nicaragua even, which was, you know, just in recent years subject to a revolution, but that revolution has been stopped by Daniel Ortega, who was a Sandinista leader.
Let's hold that thought. I want to go to break.
Sure.
And come back and talk some more about the New York Times. And by the way, did you know that Times v. Sullivan was decided the day before that I was born and appeared on the cover of the New York Times on the day that I was born? And I always thought, this is a clue about, you know, the most important Supreme Court decision.
Well, it was a significant event in addition to your birth.
No, that I have taken advantage of the fact that that decision existed throughout my entire life.
Oh, sure.
Right.
Sure, very important.
Okay, so we're speaking with Professor Carl Grossman, professor of journalism at SUNY. Used to be Old Westbury, now it's Westbury.
No, old. It's still old.
Oh, it's still old. Still because old. The old seems to have been dropped in a lot of the correspondence.
Well, it shouldn't have been. The college is being dropped, and now it's just going to be called SUNY Old Westbury as opposed to the SUNY College at Old Westbury.
I see.
But that's
they're always trying to make it a little more posh. Okay, let's listen to some music. I don't know which song, but this will be Aurora.